I have a bit of an odd story to start this episode with, so bear with me. Last week, I tasted the best fruit ever. It's not often that you get to eat something delicious for the first time in your life, especially once you hit your fourth decade. And this experience happened right in my own backyard and not on some exotic holiday or something. Let me explain. Someone told me recently that the fruit of the delicious monster plant is not just edible, but totally amazing. So that's that plant that we learned about at vet school with the big leaves, with the big holes in it that make stupid puppies salivate like crazy and scratch their mouths and gag when they try to eat it. I think it's oxalates or something in the plant that causes that horrible mouth stinging sensation. But if you look at the heart of this plant, you'll find at times a fruit, or maybe it's an inflorescence, that looks a bit like it would make a slight buzzing sound if it had an on switch. Google it, you'll see what I mean. And this thing will ripen over a period of months and months, like almost a year, to the point where it starts shedding these little hexagonal green scales to reveal underneath it a layer of soft white fruit that tastes something like a mix between banana and strawberry and heaven. Seriously, it's exquisite. But here's the catch. Those little scales shed gradually from the base of the fruit towards the tip, which is about 30 centimeters away. At a rate of around 1 centimeter every day or two. And it's only once the scales come loose that the bit of fruit underneath it is fully ripe, while the bit that hides towards the tip under the fixed scales are not ripe. And when I say not ripe, I don't mean just a bit tart or the fruit is too hard or something. No. Here's what happens. You smell that glorious smell. You eat the centimeter of exposed fruit. It's delicious, so you want more. So you use your fingernail to flick off another centimeter of scales, expecting more heaven. And then you look like one of those stupid puppies. See, the unripe fruit contains those same oxalates, whatever it is, and it's only when the fruit is ready, like totally ready, that they disappear. Eat it before, and you're left with a stinging numbness, burning sensation in your lips and your tongue and in the back of your throat that lasts for hours. Personal experience talking here. You will totally get why it's called a delicious monster. So what does this have to do with this podcast and our guest and your vet career? Well, one of my favorite things about the stories we get to hear and share on here is how our guests set off on one trajectory and then often end up way off track in a place that they could never have imagined a decade or even 5 years before. Dr. Andrew Ciccolini, our guest for this one, is a case in point. High performer, aspirations to become a top-level clinical vet, detour into the army, new skills, different interests, new opportunities. It's that slow reveal. And it's life. School, vet degree, career, maybe a business, maybe specialization, maybe something completely different. Maybe personal circumstances that interfere, hardships. In Andrew's case, a war. And if you look too far ahead, if you try to eat the whole thing in one go, you can't get it down. But 1 centimeter at a time, when the time is right, it's a delicious monster. So, who is Dr. Andrew Ciccolini? Andrew is a medical director at the National Mill Dog Rescue, a large nonprofit located in Payton, Colorado, that you'll hear more about in this discussion, and the director of not-for-profit initiatives at Galaxy Vets. His background includes serving in the U.S. Army, where he worked his way up from associate vet to VP of operations. In addition to his vet degree, he also has a master's degree in organizational leadership. In this conversation, Andrew takes us on a wild ride through his career with detours into what it's like to be a military vet, working with high-performance dogs, why choosing not-for-profit work works for him, why it might work for you, and how incorporating some of it into your business might work for your team. We draw on Andrew's military experience and his leadership masters to talk about leadership styles, how to find the balance between extrinsic and intrinsic rewards to motivate a vet team. And of course, Andrew tells us about his current work for the Galaxy Vets Foundation, supporting the pet owners in Ukraine with free telehealth services. Now, if after you've listened to this, especially the bit about the telehealth support to Ukrainian pet owners, and you feel inspired to put your hand up to volunteer your skills and time, I'll put the necessary links in the show description right here, as well as in the show notes, or you can just Google Galaxy Vets Foundation. Also, on the topic of Galaxy Vets, Back in episode 42, we had Dr. Ivan Zak on here as a guest to talk about his burnout research. Since then, Ivan has been putting all of that knowledge into practice by starting a group of vet practices that has burnout prevention built into its DNA. I've had some really cool off-air conversations with him about it, and Ivan is putting some big ideas into action that I really think could change the profession for the better. So for our US listeners and any Navoli holders who are considering a stint in the US, if you're curious to find out what Ivan's up to, what the hype is about, and if you're wondering what it would be like to be part of an employee-owned vet group, sign up at galaxyvets.com to be notified about any new job opportunities. Okay, that's my rant. Let's dive in with Dr. Andrew Ciccolini. Welcome to the Vet Vault.
Thanks for having me. Excited to talk to you, Hugh and Gerardo.
And Gerardo.
Hey, guys. Hey, team.
I'm glad it's not a video podcast. You should see Gerardo's hair.
Kind of jealous of it, I'm not going to lie.
Well, actually, there's a kind of an average here. It's like one complete spectrum, and then someone with good hair that's combed and my windswept hair, we'll call it that.
And our guest with no hair at all.
Do we have a hair product, you know, sponsoring this podcast or anything? Or?
That's right. Andrew, let's kick off officially with our first question. Bad decisions lead to good stories. Does that resonate at all? And if so, do you have any stories that would fit that mold?
Yeah, I've certainly made plenty of bad choices, decisions in life. But one that comes to mind is when I was active duty Army, they dangled a, you know, sign on for 4 more years and a $20,000 bonus, so $5,000 a year, which at the time was, you know, a lot of money to me. But when you look at the bonuses today, it's like pennies compared to what you can get. And I was thinking like, oh, I'm a lifer. I'm staying in the Army for 20 years. This is what I want to do. I love it. And the second I did that, it's like things changed and, you know, I just started being treated differently. And all of a sudden they had me hooked and they didn't have to be nice to me. And I was just stuck, you know, and it's not like a bonus you sign at a private practice where you can hire a lawyer and get out of it. With the Army, it's like, you're going to jail if you try to get out of this. Like your only option is to flee to Mexico.
Canada. Like,
yeah, you might, if I went like super far north, got into the wilderness area, maybe they just couldn't find me.
Oh gosh. Okay.
We've got to, first of all, explore this as a potential strategy for employers because of the vet shortage. Is there any way that companies can get this instituted where you go to prison if you quit?
I think if they could, they would do it already by now. Yeah. But the positive consequence was it led to a few years later, I decided maybe a career on active duty Army wasn't the right route. And I'm glad I left and I've really enjoyed the different opportunities I've had since leaving, which I know we've kind of mentioned a few of them already, and I'm sure we'll talk about them more. So the long-term outcome was good, short-term pain.
So you transitioned from the Army to vet science, I take it?
So I was a veterinarian in the Army, yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool. Share about that.
Recap the journey. So was it vet school and then went from qualifying straight into the Army or studied during the Army, or what did the journey look like?
Yep. So upon graduation, I went right into active duty. So I served in the Army for almost 9 years and moved to a number of different locations, multiple deployments, Iraq, Afghanistan, places in Africa, Korea, and decided to leave. And I'm still in the National Guard, so I do it part-time. So I still do the part-time gig to kind of finish out my retirement. And I do enjoy that, but been working in the civilian sector ever since.
In Australia, I met the vets who were involved in the Australian Army, and I think there's a grand total of four, and they're part-time. But in the States, it's big, isn't it?
Yes. For active duty Army, there's 500 veterinarians and about 1,000 to 1,200 support staff with them. And I'm actually not sure how many are in the reserves, like part-time gig, maybe twice as much.
Wow. So when you say you were active duty, was that as a veterinarian working on military animals, or what did active duty look like?
Yeah, so we had a whole host of different responsibilities, military working dogs being the most fun one, working with what is essentially a high performance athlete in a canine version, and just the capability they provide to the force. I mean, it was just awesome to work with them and try to help keep them healthy and working. And then we did have some additional responsibilities with food safety. That's kind of a historical thing for veterinarians back long, long time ago, doing meat inspection for the military to try to prevent what we call disease non-battle injury, or basically food poisoning or different illnesses associated with food. So we still have that as well. And sometimes you just never know what your job's going to be in the Army. Different things pop up and you just take it in stride and do the best you can.
So I think that came to mind, food safety. Like, do you guys eat the food first? And then if the veterinarian comes down with something, it doesn't then go out to the actual troops on the ground.
I mean, we joke about it, but are you guys familiar with MREs or meals ready to eat?
Yeah.
So that's like the packaged military meal. And that's one of our main responsibilities, is when those expire, the vet team has to go do an inspection to either extend them or condemn them. And part of that inspection is the food inspectors open them up and they smell them and they have to taste different portions of the MREs. Hopefully, so if there's a bad smell, they know not to taste it. They can just stop there, but you never know.
And that's, of course, something that we do in vet school, right? Is how to assess food safety after its expiry date.
Yep, by sniffing it, the sniff test. Like, I have this a horrible food poisoning story. It's like, I'm the kind of person who sniffs, and I was really hanging for a ham and cheese sandwich. And then I got back from work and there was cheese and there was bread, but the ham that was there was like old. So I sniffed it and I was like, ugh. I rinsed it and I was like, I'll just rinse all this bugs off. And then I made my ham and cheese toasty, and then the most horrific vomiting gastro I've ever had. I don't know if I ever learned a lesson from that, because I still do that, but that was bad. The sniff test is not very sensitive.
Well, like I said before, you want to stop at the sniff test if it doesn't smell good.
Yeah. So. At least if it doesn't smell good, that should probably be the... Maybe not.
Yeah.
Yeah, not very smart. Okay, take it.
But I'm fascinated with the working with the military dogs, Andrew. If you say they were great to work with. So are we talking German Shepherds and Malinois and those sort of breeds? Is it the stereotypical thing that I imagine to be a military dog?
Yeah, that's the most common breeds. Mostly Belgian Malinois now. They've kind of transitioned away from German Shepherds. You still see some, but just too many health problems. Occasional Dutch Shepherds. Surprisingly, a lot of Labrador Retrievers as well. They just make really good explosive detection dogs. And then sometimes you see some other breeds. Like, I've seen some Springer Spaniels that are really good vehicle search dogs. They're kind of compact size. You can put them in a vehicle to search it.
Sorry, one of my favorite marijuana toxicity cases working as an ER vet is one night the Springer Spaniel came in, clearly stoned off its face. And the owner was a young guy, and he came in, he didn't know what was wrong with it. And I said, look, he looks like he's stoned. Is there any chance that he could have had access to marijuana? He says, I don't smoke. And he's like, I visited a friend today who lives on a farm and I think he smokes. And he goes, and the dog is a retired drug sniffer dog. So it obviously just went straight for it. Knew exactly where to find it, sniffed it. I went, this time I'm going to eat it.
I finally get to eat this thing I'm not allowed to eat.
Wow. Yeah.
Ideally, the detection dogs don't eat the thing they're trained to detect.
So the Malinois, are they cool to work with? Are they that highly trained that you can do stuff with them, or do you deal with aggression issues and that with them at all?
Yeah, they're certainly a little bit crazy. So working with the handlers on enrichment can be really important, because the handlers can only work them and train them so many hours of the day. They have other responsibilities. But as we all know, Malinois have crazy high energy and drive levels. So they can develop a lot of behavioral issues if they're just spending too much time in the kennel. The vast majority of them, they're okay for us to examine them. You know, we have protocols where the handler stays with them. They're muzzled at all times. You do get an occasional one where it's like, you just cannot like examine this dog, and you have to find ways, you know, whether that's just drug them every time, or sometimes we just, like at a private practice, the dogs will associate the vet clinic with negative experiences. And so we'd have to like meet them in a random location to try to do an examination. So just coming up with novel ideas to try to make it work.
Okay. So you spent 9 years, in the armed forces in the veterinary capacity. What were your key takeaways? Yeah, what were key takeaways that you took that help you now with, you know, your endeavors, your coaching, mentoring, the like business? What was something you took away from that kind of institution or structure?
I think from a clinical standpoint, it's a lot what I just talked about, and just adapting your approach to dogs that are really stressed in the clinic and just being flexible to try to meet the dog where they are, just to try to make it a less stressful experience for them. Beyond that, I really learned a lot of leadership skills in the Army. Mm-hmm. And the Army is not necessarily great about teaching you how to be a good leader, but they give you lots of opportunities to practice it. So you kind of learn by doing, and sometimes you have good leaders and mentors that you can learn from, and you can learn just as much from the bad leaders as well. So I learned a lot about leadership and really enjoyed that aspect of the job. And that's why I chose to do a master's in organizational leadership after I left the military. Because I was like, okay, I have all this experience. I have ideas on what has worked for me in leadership and what hasn't, but what's the foundational knowledge behind it? Like, what's the theory? And I feel like that really helped me grow as a leader. And I just really enjoy that.
I'm always fascinated with leadership in the military, because in my head, so South Africa's got a very strong military history. We actually had conscription, and I just missed it, the change just before I had to join. But three of my brothers did it. And certainly my perception at that stage was that it was very much a command and listen leadership structure. There was no, I didn't have to get your buy-in as a leader or get you outside. It was just, I tell you to do this, or as you said earlier, or you go to prison. Or I get to chase you around the parade ground all day until you vomit, sort of a thing. Which I often think, well, A, is that accurate? Is that how it is? Or has it changed drastically? Is the military no longer like that?
I think that's a very common perception of the military, is it's all an authoritarian leadership style. Mm-hmm. You certainly do have some aspects of that in situations where it's required. So if you're in the heat of combat, like, you just have to kind of follow orders and take direction, right? Like, you can't, that's not the time to have a discussion. But what I saw is that those that tried to have an authoritarian leadership style at all times, they failed, because people just don't follow well when they're just being told what to do all the time, especially when there's multiple officers around, people that have doctorate degrees. Like, they don't just want to be a follower. They want to contribute. That's actually not at least the U.S. military's stance on leadership either. It's not always whoever's the highest ranking person makes all decisions and everybody else follows. And that's why we've been really successful in combat situations, because we push leadership down to the lowest level. And looking at how Russia is currently failing in the war in Ukraine, one of the big things they keep bringing up is that their people on the ground aren't allowed to make decisions. They're sitting there waiting for command to come down from higher. And that's causing just chaos for them. And that's why Ukraine is being successful in that war.
Mm, I've seen that consistently come up, because one of the things I do follow is the Ukraine war, actually. And I've heard that consistently come up in a lot of the reports around the differences between, because the Ukraine army was trained for the last several years by American trainers and things. And that flexibility and ability to take for initiative and take advantage of situations, because they do have the insight. It's kind of like the same in business, really. It's kind of, at least through my leadership journey, originally was like, tell and do. I tell you do. And then that worked to some degree, but engagement dropped significantly. And then it's really bringing the decision-making down to, wouldn't hate to say the floor, but down to the team and within the team that are actually doing the thing to help them, empower them to make decisions and give them the resources, which is a difficult transition for big organizations to make. But so with your leadership and master's in organizational leadership, what would be the challenges that you commonly come across in the veterinary space, field, practice, structure?
I think especially as I've gotten more into the corporate world, and I saw the same thing on the Army side, is that leadership styles have to be adaptable and change as you advance in your career. So what worked for you when you're just an associate veterinarian or a lead technician responsible for 5-6 people, a servant leadership style can be really successful, because you kind of get to people's intrinsic motivation and build this rapport with them and show that you care about them as a person, not just about the business itself. And so you can be really successful there. But then as you move up and you start having more direct reports and you're responsible for 100, 150 people, if you try to be a servant leader, you're just going to burn out. There's just no way possible to do that. You can't take care of 150 people that way. You can't take calls in the middle of the night. Oh, there's this problem going on. I'm coming right to your house right now. But you can choose to have that style with kind of the leaders one step below you. Mm-hmm. And so they get that from you, learn it from you, and they can treat their people below them as a servant leader. But when you're dealing with everybody else, you need to adopt a different style. Maybe that's transformational leadership. There's lots of different styles you can do. And just being able to adapt your leadership style as you change positions is really important. So that's kind of what I've seen and learned through my masters.
For most vet businesses, it will be smaller teams, right? My majority of vet businesses are smaller teams. So in that scenario, the servant leadership style, do you feel like that's, or from what you've learned, is that most applicable? And then beyond that, for the occasional bigger company where people do get into roles, what does it look like?
Yeah, I think transformational leadership is the most common that you see if a lot of changes need to occur, which is often the case, because as corporate, or as we call consolidators, buy up clinics, they're trying to change the culture and adopt it to their style. And so you need to have change. And so a transformational leadership style is more common. And a big element of that transformational leadership is kind of what we talked about before, where you allow people to have a say in the changes. We've all heard that saying, tell them what to do, don't tell them how to do it. That's a big aspect of transformational leadership. It's like, hey, here's the changes we want to make, but you're the one that's been working here. How do you see we can do this? What's the right way to do this? Do you think it's the right idea? Maybe you have a different idea, and just including them in that conversation.
Just going back to I know it's on a strict kind of guideline, you know, six and less servitude and then above. So whatever, but servant leadership, but it's maybe servant is the one that you go to naturally first, but then regardless of the number of people, ideally you want to go above that because one, it takes the pressure of you. And two, then it then transforms then, and then they start to then develop the skills and empowers them to develop leadership skills upwards as well. Otherwise, you keep staying in this servant leadership style because you're just not allowing other people to then, you know, have the freedom and space and capacity to develop themselves. So regardless of team size, the goal would be to level up beyond that level.
Definitely. And I think what we commonly see is people don't necessarily choose a leadership style and try to lead in that way. They just kind of act as themselves and they kind of self-select themselves as leaders. Like, okay, this person, people seem to follow this person. They seem to like him or her. So they're a good leader and we move them up. But I think it's really important that people look into these different styles and figure out which one works best for them and adapt to the situation. So I can't just say this leadership style is the best. You should use this one or that one, because some people may not have the skills to be a great servant leader or charismatic leader, but they might be really good at a different style.
So for somebody who is in a leadership position, so practice manager level or clinical manager or vet director or something, can you change your leadership style? Because I feel like you will have a tendency based on your personality to lead in a certain way. If the role then changes, and so let's say I'm naturally a servant leader. I like it. I have a small team and it really works very well. But now my company grows and I'm responsible for more people, or the situation changes like it is currently in Red Science where there's other stresses and demands. Is it a question of saying, well, I'm no longer the appropriate leader. Let's get somebody with the right style to take over? Or is it possible to go, well, I need to change my leadership style, even though it might clash with my values and who I am at heart? Is that doable?
I think both are doable. You definitely see people that get promoted into positions that were great leaders and they just can't make the changes in that new role and they need to be taken out of it. But I do think with committed effort, people can change and learn new leadership skills and adapt to their situation. But it's hard, and a lot of people don't know where to get that information from. And if they don't have a good mentor above them to help them adapt that leadership style, it's going to be much more difficult to be successful.
Yeah. So resources, if somebody is in that situation, do you have any that you really like that you can recommend people go to?
I think one of my favorite authors on leadership is Daniel Pink. He has a lot of different books and YouTube videos. Yeah. See, you're shaking your head. You've heard of him. I think He's pretty commonly known by people who even don't study leadership. And I think his writing is easily understandable to most people. So that's who I typically recommend. You can learn a lot from his work.
Or I listened to, I'm going to do a shout out for the Whole Vet podcast. When I was researching you, I saw you had a conversation with her on there. Great Vet podcast as well. And I liked the Little Blue Truck book that you used as a transformative leader. I have to admit, I'm not familiar with that, even though I have little kids. We never found the Little Blue Truck. But I really like the way you explain it. So I don't want to rehash the same content. If anybody wants to hear Andrew talk about what a transformational leader looks like, go look for that episode. I do want to ask a follow-up question based on that. And it's a hard question. So I don't expect, if you had the answer, then, well, you'll save a lot of vet clinics a lot of time. But I want to use that, well, an example that I see currently, and I hear a lot of veterinary leaders stuck in and really struggling with is, let's say the Little Blue Truck owns a vet clinic. He has a veterinary team who really care and they really are bought into the vision of the business and know why we do what we do. But they're understaffed. They are tired. They struggle with motivation and they don't know where the light at the end of the tunnel is. How does the Little Blue Truck deal with the situation? How does he lead that team through this difficult situation?
Yeah, that's definitely the million-dollar question. And if I nail this, I think I could probably get some good work as a consultant. Yeah. So I think we all know that it's really multifactorial. But I think in the veterinary community, we're over-reliant on intrinsic motivation to get our employees to work. Like, we all love animals. We got into this field because we really want to do it. So we have a lot of intrinsic motivation to work hard and work extra hours, but we can only do that for so long and we get burnt out. And so leaders need to try to address some extrinsic motivation factors. An example I like to use is, I'm sure we're all tired of talking about the pandemic, but when the pandemic first hit, I was working at a corporate practice and we were all kind of panicked. Like, we're not going to have any clients. Like, we're going to shut down. We're all going to lose our jobs. Right. And that lasted all of like a week and a half. And then we're like, what is going on? Like, why are we so busy? Things are insane. And I specifically remember a few times the leadership, the managers, and talked about how this is amazing. You guys have done X number of dollars of work. This is a record for us. I can't believe it. And all the team is like, we don't see any change other than we're just working harder. Like, that's not helping us. We've gotten no raise, no bonus, nothing. And I'm not saying it always has to be money, but if they're working harder and the business is benefiting, they should benefit in some way too. So addressing some of those extrinsic motivation factors, making sure they have proper reward. And when we talk about reward, it's different for every person, right? Some people may value a monetary reward. Some people may value time off. Some people want recognition. Some people don't want recognition at all. Like, have you ever had those people that just like get super uncomfortable if you acknowledge them in front of everyone? I'm kind of that way. Like, the second you start doing that, I'm like, oh no, it wasn't me. It was the team. They did it. It was all them. So understanding your team in that way, whether that's conducting a survey and sitting down with each person as a new hire, like, hey, if you do a great job, how would you like to be recognized? Just knowing those aspects of your team can really help when they're feeling just overwhelmed and burnt out.
I remember 4 or 5 years ago, went through a phase where through engagement surveys, reward and recognition was one of the areas that was highlighted that we needed to do more of. And we started doing public recognition or a public acknowledgement of people's, not necessarily achievements, but their contributions, their overcoming challenges, like the progress, and highlighting the progress towards getting better as opposed to the actual accomplishment to some degree. And then people were, exactly what you said, people were getting really uncomfortable with it. And then we go, we're like, okay, how would you like to be recognized? And it was just like, the answers we got back, we don't know. And it's just like, okay, that was really not helpful, guys. But I think over time you do learn if you are attuned to people and you ask, probably on an individual basis.
I like what you say there, Andrew, that it is individual, because I think the temptation is to go, all right, we're going to do this. We're going to have a financial bonus system where you get a percentage of earnings or something like that, which for a lot of people, they go, yes, absolutely. Let me see the dollars that I'm bringing, my share of the dollars that I'm bringing in. And then for other people, it's really not the, like, you, I see this discussion, some, especially vets, because of our attitudes about money and the feelings that we have that it's a love job, it's not for money, that actually are really uncomfortable with that, to go, well, it's interfering with my values and morals. And then the poor business owner or manager who installs this thing going, well, I'm trying to do the right thing. And now some of you are really happy and some of you are really pissed off. I don't know. What do you guys want? You can get really frustrated with it. Ask, what do you want? How do you want to be motivated?
Yeah, and I think a good example is what I'm doing right now. One of my main jobs before I started with the Galaxy Vets Foundation is working for the National Mill Dog Rescue, which is a nonprofit. And I've been working there for over 2.5 years, and I've been emailed, called, text, LinkedIn message with constant, hey, I have a $100,000 bonus if you'll come work for me. $50,000 bonus. I'll give you this starting salary. You know, and I chose to stay because money wasn't the number one priority for me. Yes, I wanted to make decent money and they pay me well enough, but there was a ton of job satisfaction. There was a lot of appreciation for the work I was doing there. I had a lot of autonomy to kind of run the clinic how I wanted to. And that was much more valuable than just money. And the recruiters didn't really understand that. They were never trying to recruit me in that method, like, hey, we can develop this job in a way that's appealing to you. It was just, here's the money, we'd love to have you. And that just wasn't drawing me in. I think we see that with a lot of vets.
So go back to this non-for-profit. What was it called again?
So National Mill Dog Rescue is where I work as a medical director right now, where we rescue commercial breeding dogs all across the United States and fix them up and adopt them out.
Okay, wow.
And then I'm part of another nonprofit, which is the Galaxy Vets Foundation, which right now our main efforts are in Ukraine, providing free telehealth services to pet owners in Ukraine, since a lot of them don't have access to veterinarians right now.
No. And so this farm rehoming of breeding dogs, what got you into that? How did you transition into that?
Yeah, it was kind of by luck mostly. You know, so I had left the Army and was working in corporate practice. And one of my best friends in town was a huge volunteer out there, and she just absolutely loved it. And anytime I saw her, she was like, you need to work for them. You need to work for them. I had talked to him a few times. I didn't really have a position at the time. And then when I finally got an opportunity to start doing some relief work out there, and so I did a few shifts, kind of learned we were a really good fit. And when the opportunity came available, they asked me if I would be interested. And it really fit with my personal life at that time, just needing more consistent hours, not, you know, staying late, things like that. The ability to say, hey, like, I just can't come today because I had a son at the time who had some medical issues. Like, hey, I need to be available for his medical appointment. And that was just a huge stress off my back when I could call the rescue and say, hey, just put those 4 or 5 dogs that are on the surgery schedule back and we'll get to them tomorrow. Whereas at private practice, it was like, hey, I can't come in today. Those 20 dogs that are on the schedule, now they're trying to move them around to everybody else's schedule and is stressing them out. And that made me feel guilty. So it was just kind of the perfect fit for me at the time.
And then within that role and capacity, did you do some work within leadership or within organization leadership within that organization?
Yeah, I think there was some change management that needed to occur when I came on there. So there was a lot of contention with the veterinary staff prior to my arrival, where there was basically no communication between the different groups within the rescue because everyone was kind of scared of the vet team, and the vet team wasn't really making the effort to make friends with everybody else. And so they were kind of in their silos. And so I had to do some work to break those down. And really, it was leadership by example was the main way I did it. Like, I spent time, despite the busy schedule, just going across the other side and getting to know volunteers, getting to know people working in adoptions, and just putting that effort in. And then slowly my team saw, like, okay, things are going to be different now. We're all going to get along. And they started doing it too. And now, like, it's just a great environment to work in.
Awesome. Because that is something that happens within practice. Even within a busy hospital, you can have that silos of teams, nurses versus nurses, vets and nurses against reception team, because they don't understand what's happening at the back and how busy you are and keep on booking people in.
Day team versus night team, right?
Oh, that's a big one. Day team versus night team.
It's always the fault of the emergency team.
Yeah, sometimes it's just that individual that walks across the aisle and makes that relationship. But also I think you can kind of do some horizontal leveling and have teams, even though they may be a technician who's more qualified, hey, go work with the reception team today and use your knowledge to help them. And they start building those relationships on that team. And then the receptionists become more comfortable coming to the vet tech team or vet nurse team, asking the questions. Whereas before they might be hesitant to do so because they've been yelled at before, kind of discarded. As you start building those relationships between the teams and slowly breaking down those silos.
That's really helpful.
That is. Andrew, the not-for-profit work, so that was the first one, was the Mill Dog. And you said you took that job because of the practicalities to some degree. But now being involved in the Galaxy Vets and their not-for-profit arm, what is it about the not-for-profit work that, I suppose, that ticks your boxes, that makes you want to do more of it?
Yeah, I think I've just always been that way. I grew up and was raised Catholic. I'm not necessarily still religious, but I went to a private, what we call Jesuit universities in high school. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Jesuit sect of the Catholic faith, but they just had a heavy, heavy emphasis on service to others, education and service. And so I did a lot of service projects and just kind of learned that I really liked it. And that was a big reason why I joined the Army too. Like, I just wanted to give back. I felt like I've had so much given to me, and you know, I had a family that was really supportive and helped me along the way, and I had all these advantages in life, and so I wanted to help those that maybe didn't have as many as I did. So joining the Army to give back to the country, had an opportunity in the Army to do projects helping in third world countries. And so the second I had another opportunity to get back into the nonprofit world, I took it because I just find it really rewarding.
I get that. I see this. I experience this, and I'm sure a lot of other people do. There's a conflict that we have because on the one end, I firmly believe that we have to have successful businesses so that we can take care of those external rewards that you mentioned earlier, so that we can prevent the burnout and all the stuff that we talk about all the time. But then also there's the desire to give. So there's there's a friction there between that. Well, we've got to make money, but I also want to feel that I am giving, like I'm a good person. We all started down this path because we want to take care of animals. We want to preserve the relationship between animals and their owners. But then to make a really successful business, you often have to go against those instincts and say, no, we can't do that for less, or I can't do this because you can't afford it. And how do you make these two gel? Because you sound like you like that as well. Is it something that you struggle with? And then B, how do you deal with it? And how do we deal with it as a profession?
Well, I think you bring up a really good point of like the business needs to be successful, right? Like, we can't help people if none of us have jobs. So what we see a lot in the business world is businesses don't really look to do charity work or stand up their foundations until they're already super successful and they've made a lot of money. But that's one of the reasons I'm really proud of Galaxy Vets, because they're a startup. I mean, they only own a few practices right now and they've already stood up a foundation. And I'm really adamant about the foundation benefiting the business side as well. So I think if you're working in the nonprofit world or working for a corporation that has some charity work, you need to be able to communicate what's the value to the business as well. And I think a lot of us get kind of icky feelings over that, but there's nothing wrong with a business benefiting from their charity work also. It just makes it more sustainable. And we call it strategic corporate social responsibility. It's kind of the business term for it. So aligning your nonprofit work with your business values and having it benefit the business in positive ways doesn't necessarily have to just be monetary, will make it more sustainable.
How?
So when I say more sustainable, I mean making the charity work more sustainable, because the second the business is struggling for money, what's the first thing they're going to cut? It's going to be the charity work. But if you can show like, hey, here's the benefits to what we're doing, this is how it's helping your business, they're more likely to continue it. So we haven't dug in a lot into the Galaxy Vets Foundation and what we've been doing, but we mentioned how we're doing telehealth with veterinary volunteers for pet owners in Ukraine. So what's the benefit for Galaxy Vets business side? Well, Galaxy Vets is really intent on developing telemedicine within their veterinary healthcare system in the US. So they had an opportunity to build and test a platform and learn some things about how to effectively administer teletriage and telehealth. So that's one benefit. There's also not a really good understanding of telehealth within the veterinary community. I don't know if it's different in Australia, but certainly, and even with the pandemic, people just like really uncomfortable with it. They don't like it. And we've had over 250 volunteers who now have more comfort with telemedicine. And so that helps when the business needs to promote telehealth, like, hey, there's more people out there that are comfortable with it. They'll share it with their friends and say, hey, it's not that hard. Like, you can do it.
Cool. I want to come back to telemedicine and what you guys have been learning from this, because it's what a cool training ground. And I'd love to hear some stories from the, well, let's just start with that. Give us a bit more detail of what that looks like. And have you got any cool stories from that? And then also, what are you learning from it? What have you learned? Because I'm like you, the concept of veterinary telemedicine, I really struggle with. I'm like, well, I've got to put my hands on an animal to actually intimidate me, because I'm aware of, through knowing Ivan, of what you guys do. And I haven't, to my shame, I haven't signed up yet. I thought, I've got to do this. I've got to give it a try. And I didn't, because I was just too scared. I was like, well, how am I going to help somebody on the other side of the world with their pet on telemedicine? And I was literally just too intimidated by it.
Well, we would absolutely love to have you as a volunteer, but to kind of give some background on it, we elected to do a chat-based platform because we needed the translation services. So having a video-based platform just wouldn't be possible, because the vast majority of Ukrainians don't speak English and we don't have very many Ukrainian-speaking volunteers. So we chose to do a chat-based platform. So since we've started, we've actually exceeded over 20,000 pet owners helped, which is way more than I ever thought possible. So the demand has been really high. We have a couple advantages working in Ukraine in that there's not as many laws and restrictions on what we can do to help them. So that's one of the biggest challenges in the US and why I think people are really hesitant to get into telehealth, is the rules are really murky around what can I do for a pet if I haven't put my hands on it? Whereas in Ukraine, we reached out to like their Ministry of Health and just made sure, like, hey, is there going to be any issue with us providing medical advice? And they said, no, like, please help us out. And so we've been able to do our best with diagnosing and prescribing. So another benefit in Ukraine is a lot of their medications can be purchased from a local pharmacy without a prescription. So that has helped a lot. But we're definitely seeing strategies within the US develop through Chewy and different companies that you get telehealth can prescribe medications and just have it shipped directly to their house. So I do think this will be a solution coming in the North American market. I'm sure it'll end up in Australia as well. We've had some crazy cases. We've had a lot of just your routine cases. But I think what a lot of our volunteers have seen is you can really help them. A lot of them don't have access to any veterinary care at all. So anything you can do to help, even if it's just providing emotional support to that pet owner, can be really impactful. And so we've had a few cases where, you know, the animal is really injured or really sick and there's not a lot you can do, and you're just there for the person. And I feel like that's just as important. Yes, we want to help the animals, but in a time of tragedy as this war, pets become so much more important to people. And we talk about that human-animal bond all the time and our impact we can have on that, even if we're not treating the animal, but just being there for the person is just so huge.
So linking that back, so you talked about how the telehealth service, it links back to an organizational goal of bringing telehealth and getting people used to telehealth within North America, right? And then working through that process to develop the systems. Right. So you're developing a system to an outcome that you want to achieve within your organization itself. But then that desire to help others, that desire to help people in need, is overcoming the pains and challenges. Like it's like the outcome that you want to achieve overcomes the pain of change and process and all the fears that come associated with that, because there's a higher purpose to that. Is that what you guys are finding in a sense?
Definitely. I think we've seen that from our volunteers mostly, because like we talked about already, a lot of them came into it just really uncomfortable with the idea of telehealth. And the feedback we've received were, I'm so glad I did this. I just felt like I was able to help people. And it was just, it got back to that intrinsic motivation that we kind of lose when we're just overwhelmed day to day working in a vet clinic and having people yelling at you. And they're like, I was just able to help people and their pets. And it was amazing. And it was rejuvenating. And so it's been an awesome experience.
Yeah, that's what I often think about, is how do we get that disconnect? Because I've experienced that with charitable work as well. When I volunteered in Indonesia doing sterilization work. And somehow when you do that, you don't get tired. Thoughts of burnout or self-pity of like, oh, it was such a long shift, poor me. That never crossed my mind. It's just, you're out there, it's basic work, it's scrappy, like you're doing stuff on a kitchen table and things go wrong and it's hot and uncomfortable and there's flies. And I don't know, is it just the change of scenery or is it an intrinsic motivator that goes, well, this is good work. That's why I can do it all day. I was literally running through the bush for 14 hours trying to catch these dogs to de-sex them versus all these... We had to dart them. It's really fun. You like it, Andrew.
Come here. I'm just trying to help you. Douche.
Dark.
Exactly. And then yet when we're at work doing kind of the same kind, maybe it is, maybe that's the problem. It's not the same kind of work. Maybe pampered pets and paranoid owners who whinge about small little things are draining versus, well, the shit I'm doing here is real. It's real and it's an impactful. Do you think I'm on the right? Like, why do you think there is that disconnect of why can you do the one without complaint? And I often think about when we complain about workers' vets, I'm very much in the camp of it has to get better, because I was dissatisfied as a vet for such a long time. And then I look at other situations like the war in the Ukraine or dramatic big things that people go through and they do it and they keep going. And then I go, well, why are we so soft? Why do you think there's a disconnect and how do we bring it back into everyday life, into the jobs that we do?
I don't know that I have the answer, but I think money is a distorting factor. We have to work for a job, but it makes me think of when we very first started this initiative and we were getting our first volunteers, we were struggling to reach Ukrainian pet owners. And so we didn't have like a lot of questions. It was only a few a day. And so we'd have volunteers logged in for, 2 hours, whatever. And they were just so disappointed, like, oh, I just wasn't really able to help very many people. Whereas if they were getting paid to do that job and there was nobody to talk to, they would have, kicked their feet up and been like sipping their coffee, like ka-ching, like, yes, So I have to think that it's a contributing factor. And that's not to say we shouldn't get paid for our job. I think we all know we should, but I think it just has some negative impacts that are hard to fix.
So is that maybe a potential fix for it, is to integrate it? Does that come back to having not-for-profit arms as part of a business? Is that one of the potential payoffs, is to say, well, you have your paid job, but rolled into that, we offer X. This is where we get involved in, and to tick those boxes of going, well, this is why I really do it. I don't know. Is that because you talked about for a business to have a sustainable charitable arm, how do you sell it to the business?
I think you do see a lot of businesses that may not have their own charitable arm, but they will allow employees to work X number of days a year at a charity and they'll pay them. And I think that's maybe not for everybody, but going back to those individual rewards type of thing, a lot of people might be really motivated by that. And I think a lot of people in our community would like, okay, a couple times a year, I'm still getting paid, but I'm going to help someone else. I think they would really enjoy that.
I have a random question for you, Andrew. When I was Googling you, sort of researching you and looking at the stuff you've done, I found your social profile, The OK Vet. Why The OK Vet? Why did you choose that? So that's Andrew's. If you want to find him on Instagram, he's The OK Vet.
I think it's because it's honest. I think one of the big stressors to me for veterinarians is we have to know so much, right? Like, we talk about it all the time. We're the dentist, we're the anesthesiologist, we're the surgeon, we're the internal medicine specialist. And we get so stressed out because we want to be perfect or the best at all of those. And when I finally accepted, like, I'm just okay as a vet. I have some strengths and I have some weaknesses. My mental health really improved. I wasn't as stressed at work. And so that's where the title comes from, is Okay Vet.
I really like that, because we're a driven bunch, right? We're not, as veterinarians specifically, we're used to doing well. Like, you don't get into vet without doing really well at school and getting chosen. And I find that, again, experience it and find it all the time, is that need for high performance and perfection all the time, which is really draining and really exhausting. And was that you? Were you that sort of person, or were you always happy with being the okay vet?
I don't think I was always happy. Like, I really wanted to go to a residency and become really specialized and do the best at something. And just over time, I just kind of evolved. And the Army, I think, presented some unique challenges because we were in and out of clinical work so much. Like, I might do clinical work for a week and then I'm off doing a mission somewhere for 3-4 weeks. And then I'm back in the clinic, and it got really hard to become good at it. It became very stressful. And so it really wasn't until after I left and was in private practice and able to do it every day, I just started seeing, like, okay, I just can't be great at all of this. And I need to learn how to be okay with being okay.
So how did you make peace with that?
I don't think it was like a moment in time. It was just kind of a slow realization. And yeah, I think I just had to do it to protect my mental health and just accept the skills I had. It doesn't mean you stop trying to improve. And, you know, it's not like ophthalmology is one thing I just really struggle with. So it's not like I'm like, oh, any eye thing, I'm just not going to look at it. Certainly, if you're in a larger practice, you might have someone that's really good at that and you can share that caseload, but I still put the effort in to do as best I can, but I'm just not going to get crushed over the fact that I'm not going to be an expert.
Yeah. It's a journey, right? It just takes a while to get there. But I like that you actually named it and you went, I am the okay vet and I'm okay with being okay. And that's fine.
Yep.
Quick plug for our clinical podcasts. Andrew talks here about being okay with being okay. But here's the thing. Over time, if you don't guard against it, okay as a vet can become a little bit, let's call it south of okay, a little bit rusty. Our clinical podcasts aim to maintain okay and then nudge beyond okay, all the way to, hey, I kind of know my shit. Like Andrew says, accepting being okay doesn't mean that you stop improving. And because of the way our content is presented, mostly audio, easy to consume on the go, bit by bit, with great notes to refer back to when you need them, we do the nudging without sacrificing the other things in your life that matters to you. We're back to that delicious monster concept, right? 1 centimeter at a time. Give it a try for free at vvn.supercast.com.
Wait, let's do the pass it along question first. So I'm going to get you to give me a question that I'm going to ask our next guest, not knowing who the next guest is. But you get a question first from my previous guest. And our previous guest wanted to know, if Andrew was not a vet, what would he have done for a living?
Yeah, and I spent some time thinking about this, because as most of us, like, I was bent on being a veterinarian. Like, there was nothing else I was going to do. It had to be a veterinarian. And I don't know what would have happened if I didn't succeed. But if I had to pick, I think it would have been one of two things. I either would have still gone into the Army just as some other specialty, whether it's infantry or armor or something, or I would have went to some other type of medical field, like maybe pharmacy, PA, something like that.
Okay. So not too vastly different. You weren't going to be a ballerina or an artist or something like that.
No, I had no artistic talent growing up. So.
Okay, cool. So what's your question for my next guest?
My question would be, what is your favorite dog breed and why is it Chihuahuas?
My kids actually watched Beverly Hills Chihuahua this week, which is, I was sort of watching in the background. And so that would be my answer. That's why, because they're adventurous.
It harkens back to my social media. If you watch the videos, I talk about Chihuahuas a lot.
Why? Where's the Chihuahua fixation from? It's a far cry from Belgian Malinois, isn't it?
It is. And I've pretty much always been a big dog person. I've had big dogs. And then my wife brought a tiny little Chihuahua into the mix. He was only like 3.5 pounds. And he was just the perfect dog, just friendly with everybody, which I know isn't a typical Chihuahua. Just wanted to cuddle all the time. And I just loved him to death. He was just the best little dog. And then working at the National Mill Dog Rescue, we get a lot of small dogs and just kind of started enjoying them more and more, even when they're spicy. I don't care how spicy of a Chihuahua it is. I still love them.
That's the thing. I have this weird thing. I don't like big, aggressive dogs. That's partially why I asked you about the military dogs. Because it's a big dog that can actually hurt me. There's definitely a fear factor there, right? It's a sort of, I don't really want to see this dog because I'm shit scared of it. But with small dogs, it's become almost humorous. I'm like, yeah, you go nuts, man. You try and kill me. All I have to do is put a towel over your head and then you're disarmed. You can't actually hurt me. The really angry Chihuahua fascinates me. I find it hilarious. I just need to check. So did you get a Chihuahua while you were still in the military or was it post-military days? Because I'm just picturing you rocking up at work with your Chihuahua in a handbag.
Yeah, I was still in the military, and I do remember one time I brought him in to work because he was kind of sick, and I actually had my boss come down. He was a radiologist and do an ultrasound for me, and he was just totally shocked that I would have such a tiny little dog.
Exactly. I can just imagine those dog handlers seeing the vet who takes care of their dogs with his Chihuahua.
Yeah, and it doesn't bother me. I think it's hilarious.
It's cold. Andrew, do you listen to podcasts? Are you a podcast fan?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned The Whole Veterinarian, and that was the first podcast I did, and connected with Dr. Stacy Cordovano through Instagram. Kind of one of my first connections through Instagram, which we call it the Vetstagram community, is really amazing and supportive. So I always listen to hers. I think she does a great job. The Veterinary Innovation Podcast, which is done by Dr. Ivan Zak, who is the CEO of Galaxy Vets and helped me stand up the Galaxy Vets Foundation. Really good topics there. So those are the two main ones I listen to.
Okay. Do you stick to the vet stuff?
Yep.
Yeah. And then our very last question, Andrew, is the one question, the big question. So you're at a talk somewhere, an online event, and you have all of the veterinary new grads in one room, and you've got a couple of minutes to just give them one message or one bit of advice for their careers and their lives. What is your message?
My message is to not be afraid to reinvent themselves. I think a lot of times we go into veterinary school and we're focused on like, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to be, whether that's general practice or an equine veterinarian or food animal veterinarian. And I think now there's just even more and more opportunities for us to use the skills we have in different roles. Mm-hmm. And it can just keep things fresh and make you a better veterinarian. So you could be in general practice for 3 years and then maybe step out and work for the state government for a few years, then go back to GP. And I bet you'd be a better general practice veterinarian. So don't be afraid to reinvent yourself and try to avoid burnout that way.
I really like that because I think that maybe it's a thought process or the belief is that if I have this journey and again, it comes back to wanting to be the superstar versus just being okay. I can't detour. If I want to be a really good small animal surgeon or an ophthalmologist or something, this is the journey and I've got to stick to it. And anything that pulls me off that track is going to be a distraction and a waste of time potentially. But I like what you say, and I've heard so many people say it. There's those little detours and distractions that either can open up a whole new field or add value when you come back to the thing that you want to do, if you still want to do that thing.
Yeah, and I mean, you're doing it, right? Like you have a podcast. Did you ever podcast didn't even really exist back when we went to vet school, but from emergency veterinarian to hosting a podcast, I mean, I think that's really cool. And then you tell me, has it been a rewarding adventure? And
100%. Yeah, it's exactly. And was it something on my radar? No, absolutely not. I remember, and it's just interesting when you talked about that desire to be so good. I remember at uni having a conversation with a friend and we sort of talked about our goals in final year and getting ready to enter the work world. And we're talking about what do we want from our careers. And I remember saying to him, I'd love it. I'd love to be the vet who other vets call for advice. And what an ego-driven thing, isn't it? To go, I just want to be that good that other people look up to me and call me for clinical advice. And finding over the years, that doesn't really tick my boxes. And right back at you, man, look at what you're doing. Starting a non-for-profit that I think is going to do great things. That's amazing. How did that happen, by the way? How did you cross paths with Ivan and Galaxy?
It was kind of by chance, you know. So I was homesick from COVID, just locked in the basement, isolating from the family, and came across an advertisement for Galaxy Vets. Okay. And looked more into it and just really aligned with their ideas on how to improve the veterinary healthcare system. And so I attended one of their meetups and I was like, this is it. Like, I want to work for this company. And so I reached out to Ivan directly and just tried to pitch him like, hey, like, I want to be a part of this. And at the time he didn't have anything available. And he was like, you know what? I would love to have you work with me. As soon as something comes up, I will let you know. And for those that don't know, you know, Ivan's originally from Ukraine. He emigrated to North America around 20 years ago. So the second the war kicked off, he called me up and he's like, I want to do this and I want you to do it for me. Will you come on board? And I didn't even hesitate. I was like, absolutely.
Well, there's another thing to add to your one message to new grads is go for the things you want, right? If you see it, don't wait for the job ad to come up or something. Go put yourself out there and put your hand up. You'll be amazed how often you get picked. Right, yeah. Thank you so, so much for your time and thank you for what you do. And I'm very curious to see what the next thing is for the not-for-profit arm once the war in Ukraine is over and that's not necessary anymore. And we'd like to see where you guys go with it. And thank you for doing it, man.
Yeah, and thanks for hosting me and helping us, you know, just kind of spread awareness of what we're doing.
How are you feeling about work for the year ahead? We started this podcast to help you find ways to make your vet degree and the career you build around it fit with the life you want to live. Or if that's too ambitious, then at the very least, to make work not suck. And I personally thought that the answers to a fulfilling, happy career as a vet lay in personal growth and better workplaces and all of the other non-clinical stuff that we talk about. Which is true, but something that surprised me when we started doing the clinical podcasts was how big a role that played in my personal enjoyment of work. And judging by the feedback we get from our listeners, it's a common occurrence. Here's why I think it is. It sucks to feel in the dark with your cases, to feel green or rusty in your knowledge. You feel guilty because you feel like you should know more and you should be learning more, but you're also trying to have a life outside of vet, so ongoing learning falls by the wayside. On the flip side, it's a really nice feeling to know your stuff. When you get that case, to know the answer. Or if there isn't an answer, to know that it's not because of your lack of knowledge. It's just one of those cases. Competence breeds confidence, and confidence is key. And our clinical podcast is the easiest way to work on your competence. Little bits of growth every week with minimal effort on your part. Try it. It works. Join our growing community of VetFelt nerds and get your mojo back at vvn.supercast.com.